from Nicholas Young's grandma's house. So, you should have seen the size of the place.
大更粗啊, Wai Moon said.
Big doesn't even begin to describe it. The house was huge, but you should have seen the land. Do you know that there is an enormous piece of private land right next door to the Botanic Gardens?
Next to the Botanic Gardens?
Yes, off Gallup Road. It's on a street I've never even heard of called Tyersall Avenue.
Near those old wooden houses? Nina asked.
Yes, but this wasn't one of the colonial houses. The architecture was very unusual, sort of orientalist, and the gardens were unbelievable, probably around 50 acres or more.
Bullshit la, Wai Moon said.
Papa, I'm telling you, the property was immense. It was like the Istana. The driveway itself went on for miles.
Cannot be. 2 or 3 acres, I might believe, but 50? No such thing, La.
It was 50 acres at least, probably more. I thought I was dreaming. I thought I was in another country.
Lu Lin Zua, Nina looked at her daughter in concern.
No, Mum, I haven't been drinking, Picklin said in annoyance.
Show me, Wai Moon said, his interest piqued. Let's see it on Google Earth.
They walked over to the computer desk in the corner, pulled up the program, and Picklin began searching for the place. As they zoomed in on the topographical screen, she immediately noticed something amiss in the satellite image.
Look, Papa, this whole patch is empty. You think it's part of the Botanic Gardens, but it's not. This is where the house is. But why are there no images? It doesn't appear on Google Earth at all. And my GPS couldn't find the address either.
Wai Moon stared at the screen. The place his daughter claimed to have seen was literally a black hole on the map. It did not officially exist. How very strange.
Who is this fellow's family? He asked.
I don't know, but there were a lot of VIP cars in the driveway. I saw quite a few diplomatic license plates. Old Rolls Royces, vintage Daimlers, that type of car. These people must be loaded beyond belief. Who do you think they are?
I can't think of anyone specifically who lives in this area.
Wai Moon ran the cursor over the perimeter of the blacked-out area. His family had been in the property development and construction business in Singapore for more than 40 years, but he had never come across anything like this.
Wow, this is prime land, right in the middle of the island. The value would be incalculable. Cannot be one property, La.
Yes, it is, Papa. I saw it with my own eyes. And supposedly, Nick's grandmother grew up there. It's her house.
Make Rachel find out the grandma's name and the grandpa. We need to know who these people are. How can one person own this much private land in one of the most crowded cities in the world?
Wow, it looks like Rachel too has hit jackpot. I hope she marries this guy.
Nina chimed in from her recliner.
Aya, who cares about Rachel Chu? Picklin, you go after him, Wai Moon declared.
Picklin grinned at her father and began texting Rachel. Wai Moon patted his wife on her shoulder.
Come, call the driver. Let's take a drive down Tyersall Road. I want to see this place for myself.
They decided to take the Audi SUV in an effort to be as inconspicuous as possible.
See? I think this is where the property actually begins,
Picklin noted as they turned onto the curving, densely wooded road.
I think all this on the left side is the southern boundary of the land.
When they reached the gray iron gates, Wai Moon made the driver stop the car for a minute. The place looked completely deserted.
See? You wouldn't think there's anything here. It looks like some old section of the Botanic Gardens. There's another guard house farther down this road, a high-tech one manned by Gurkha guards,
Picklin explained. Wai Moon stared down the unlit, overgrown road, completely fascinated. He was one of Singapore's leading property developers, and he knew every square inch of land on the island, or at least he thought he did. Chapter 4 Rachel and Nick, Tyersall Park.
The Tanhuas are coming into bloom, Ling Chia announced excitedly to everyone on the terrace.
As the guests began to head back in through the conservatory, Nick pulled Rachel aside.
Here, let's take a shortcut, he said.
Rachel followed him through a side door, and they wandered down a long hallway past many darkened rooms that she longed to peek into. When Nick led her through an arch at the end of the passage, Rachel's jaw dropped in disbelief. They were no longer in Singapore. It was as if they had stumbled onto a secret cloister deep within a Moorish palace. The vast courtyard was enclosed on all sides, but completely open to the sky. Elaborately carved columns lined the arcades around its perimeter, and an Andalusian fountain protruded from the stone wall, spouting a stream of water from a lotus blossom sculpted out of rose quartz. Overhead, hundreds of copper lanterns had been meticulously strung across the courtyard from the second-floor walkway, each flickering with candlelight.
"I wanted to show you this place while it was still empty," Nick said in a hushed voice, pulling Rachel into an embrace.
"Pinch me, please. Is any of this real?" Rachel whispered as she looked into Nick's eyes.
"This place is very real."
"You're the dream," Nick answered as he kissed her deeply. A few guests began to trickle in, disrupting the spell they had momentarily been under.
"Come, it's dessert time," Nick said, rubbing his hands together in anticipation.
Along one of the arcades stretched long banquet tables that displayed a wondrous selection of desserts. There were elaborate cakes, soufflés, and sweet puddings, nonya kuehs in every color of the rainbow, and goreng pisang, banana fritters deep-fried in batter and drizzled with Lyle's golden syrup. Tall, polished samovars filled with different steaming hot elixirs lined the bar, and servers wearing white toques stood behind each table, ready to dish out the delicacies.
"Tell me, this isn't how your family eats every day," Rachel said in amazement.
"Well, tonight was leftovers night," Nick deadpanned.
Rachel elbowed him in the ribs playfully.
"Ow! And I was about to offer you a slice of the best chocolate chiffon cake in the world.
I just stuffed my face with 18 different types of noodles. I couldn't possibly eat dessert," Rachel groaned, pressing her palm against her stomach momentarily. She walked to the center of the courtyard, where chairs were arranged around a reflecting pool. In the middle of the pool were huge terracotta urns that held the painstakingly cultivated tanhuas. Rachel had never seen a species of flora quite so exotic. The tangled forests of plants grew together into a tall profusion of large floppy leaves the color of dark jade. Long stems sprouted from the edges of the leaves, curving until they formed huge bulbs. The pale reddish petals curled tightly like delicate fingers grasping a silken white peach. Oliver stood by the flowers, scrutinizing one of the bulbs closely.
"How can you tell they are about to bloom?" Rachel asked him.
"See how swollen they become, and how the whiteness of the bulbs are peeking through these red tentacles? Within the hour, you will see them open fully. You know, it's considered to be very auspicious to witness tanhuas blooming in the night."
"Really?"
"Yes, indeed. They bloom so rarely and so unpredictably, and it all happens so fast. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event for most people, so I'd say you're very lucky to be here tonight."
As Rachel strolled around the reflecting pool, she noticed Nick under an arcade chatting intently with a striking lady who had been sitting next to Nick's grandmother.
"Who is that woman talking to Nick? You were with her earlier," Rachel asked.
"Oh, that's Jacqueline Ling, an old family friend."
"She looks like a movie star," Rachel commented.
"Yes, doesn't she? I've always thought that Jacqueline looks like a Chinese Catherine Deneuve, only more beautiful."
"She does look like Catherine Deneuve, and aging better, too."
"Well, she's not that old. What is she, in her early 40s? Try adding 20 years to that."
"You're kidding," Rachel said, staring in awe at Jacqueline's ballerina-like figure, shown to great advantage by the pale yellow halter top and palazzo pants that she wore with a pair of silver stilettos.
"I've always thought it a bit of a pity that she hasn't done more with herself than disarm men with her looks," Oliver observed.
"Is that what she's done?"
"Widowed once, almost married a British marquis, and since then she's been the companion of a Norwegian tycoon. There's a story I heard as a child. Jacqueline's beauty was so legendary that when she visited Hong Kong for the first time in the 60s, her arrival attracted a throng of spectators, as if she were Elizabeth Taylor. All the men were clamoring to propose to her, and fights broke out at the terminal. It made the newspapers, apparently."
"All because of her beauty?"
Yes, and her bloodline. She's the granddaughter of Ling Yin Chao.
Who's that?
He was one of Asia's most revered philanthropists. Built schools all over China. Not that Jacqueline is following in his footsteps, unless you consider her donations in aid of Manolo Blahnik.
Rachel laughed as both of them noticed that Jacqueline had one hand on Nick's upper arm, stroking it gently.
Don't worry. She flirts with everyone, Oliver quipped.
Do you want another piece of juicy gossip?
Please. I'm told Nick's grandmother very much wanted Jacqueline for Nick's father, but she didn't succeed.
He wasn't swayed by her looks?
Well, he already had another beauty on his hands. Nick's mother.
You haven't met Auntie Elle yet, have you?
No, she went away for the weekend.
How interesting.
She never goes away when Nicholas is in town, Oliver said, turning around to make sure no one was within earshot before leaning closer in.
I tread extra carefully around Eleanor Young, if I were you.
She maintains a rival court, he said mysteriously, before walking off toward the cocktails table.
Nick stood at one end of the desserts, wondering what to have first. The goreng pisang with ice cream, the blancmange with mango sauce, or the chocolate chiffon cake.
Oh, your cook's chocolate chiffon. Now this is the reason I came tonight.
Jacqueline ran her fingers through her shoulder-length curls and then brushed her hand softly against his arm.
So, tell me, why haven't you been calling Amanda? You've only seen her a handful of times since she moved to New York.
We tried getting together a couple of times this spring, but she's always overbooked. Isn't she dating some high-flying hedge fund guy?
It's not serious. That man is twice her age.
Well, I see her pictures in the newspapers all the time.
That's just the problem. That has to stop. It's so unseemly. I want my daughter to mix with quality people, not the so-called Asian jet set in New York. All those pretenders are riding Amanda's coattails. She's just too naive to see that.
Oh, I don't think Mandy's that naive.
She needs proper company, Nikki. Garginang. All kind of people. I want you to look out for her. Will you promise to do that for me?
Of course. I spoke to her last month, and she told me that she was too busy to come back for Colin's wedding.
Yes, it's too bad, isn't it?
I'll call her when I'm back in New York, but I do think I'm far too boring for Amanda these days.
No, no. She would benefit from spending more time with you. You were so close once upon a time. Now, tell me about this charming girl you've brought home to meet your grandmother. I see she's already won over Oliver. You better tell her to be careful with him. He's such a vicious gossip, that one.
Astrid and Rachel sat by the lotus fountain, watching a lady dressed in flowing apricot silk robes play a guqin, the traditional Chinese zither. Rachel was entranced by the mesmerizing speed of the lady's long red fingernails plucking gracefully at the strings, while Astrid desperately tried to stop obsessing over what Oliver had said earlier. Could he have really seen Michael walking with some little boy in Hong Kong? Nick sank into the chair next to her, dexterously balancing two steaming cups of tea with one hand and holding a plate of half-eaten chocolate chiffon cake with the other. He handed the cup with smoked lychee tea to Astrid, knowing it was her favorite, and offered some cake to Rachel.
You've got to try this. It's one of our cook Ah Ching's greatest hits.
A la Mac, Nikki. Get her a proper piece of her own,
Astrid scolded, temporarily snapping out of her funk. It's okay, Astrid. I'll just eat most of his, like always, Rachel explained with a laugh. She tasted the cake, her eyes widening instantly. It was the perfect combination of chocolate and cream, with an airy melt-in-your-mouth lightness.
I like that it isn't too sweet. That's why I can never eat other chocolate cakes. They're always too sweet, too dense, or have too much frosting, Nick said.
Rachel reached over for another bite. Just get the recipe, and I'll try making it at home. Astrid arched her eyebrows.
You can try, Rachel, but trust me, my cook has tried, and it never comes out quite this good. I suspect Ah Ching's withholding some secret ingredient.
As they sat in the courtyard, the tightly rolled red petals of the tanhuas unfurled like a slow-motion movie to reveal a profusion of feathery white petals that kept expanding into an explosive sunburst pattern. I can't believe how big these flowers are getting, Rachel observed excitedly.
It always reminds me of a swan ruffling its wings about to take flight, Astrid remarked.
Or maybe about to go into attack mode, Nick added. Swans can get really aggressive.
My swans were never aggressive, Great Aunt Rosemary said as she walked up, overhearing Nick's comment.
Don't you remember feeding the swans in my pond when you were a little boy?
I remember being rather afraid of them, actually, Nick replied. I would break off little bits of bread, throw them into the water, and then run for cover. Nicky was a little wimp, Astrid teased. Was he? Rachel asked in surprise.
Well, he was so tiny. For the longest time, everyone was afraid that he would never grow up. I was so much taller than him.
And then suddenly he shot up, Astrid said. Hey, Astrid, stop discussing my secret shame, Nick said with a mock frown.
Nicky, you have nothing to be embarrassed about. After all, you've grown up to be quite the strapping specimen, as I'm sure Rachel would agree,
Great Aunt Rosemary said saucily. The women all laughed. As the flowers continued to transform before her eyes, Rachel sat sipping lychee tea from a red porcelain cup, entranced by everything around her. She watched the Sultan taking pictures of his two wives in front of the blossoms, their jewel-embroidered kabayas reflecting shards of light every time the camera flash went off. She observed the cluster of men sitting in a circle with Astrid's father, who was engrossed in a heated political debate, and she looked at Nick, now crouched beside his grandmother. She was touched to see how caring Nick seemed to be with his grandmother, holding the old lady's hands as he whispered into her ear.
"Is your friend having a nice time tonight?"
Su Yi asked her grandson in Cantonese.
"Yes, Ama. She's having a lovely time. Thank you for inviting her."
"She seems to be quite the talk of the town. Everyone is either trying delicately to ask me about her or trying delicately to tell me things about her."
"Really? What have they been saying?"
Some are wondering what her intentions are. "Your cousin Cassandra even called me from England, all flustered up."
Nick was surprised.
"How does Cassandra even know about Rachel?"
Only the ghosts know where she gets her information. But she is very concerned for you. She thinks you are going to get trapped."
"Trapped? I'm just on holiday with Rachel, Ama. There's nothing to be concerned about," Nick said defensively, annoyed that Cassandra had been gossiping about him.
"That's exactly what I told her. I told her that you are a good boy and that you would never do anything without my blessing. Cassandra must be bored out of her mind in the English countryside. She's letting her imagination run as wild as her silly horses."
"Would you like me to bring Rachel over, Ama, so that you can get to know her better?" Nick ventured.
"You know, I won't be able to stand all the craning necks if that happens. Why don't you both just come to stay next week? It's so silly to be staying at a hotel when your bedroom is waiting right here."
Nick was thrilled to hear these words from his grandmother. He had her seal of approval now.
"That would be wonderful, Ama."
In a corner of the darkened billiard room, Jacqueline was in the midst of a heated phone conversation with her daughter, Amanda, in New York.
"Stop making excuses. I don't give a damn what you told the press. Do what you have to do, but just make sure you're back next week," she fumed.
Jacqueline ended her call, looking out the window at the moonlit terrace.
"I know you're there, Oliver," she said sharply, not turning around.
Oliver emerged from the shadowy doorway and approached slowly.
"I can smell you from a mile away. You need to lay off the Blenheim bouquet. You're not the Prince of Wales."
Oliver arched his eyebrows. "Aren't we getting testy? Anyway, it's quite clear to me that Nicholas is completely smitten. Don't you think it's a little too late for Amanda?"
"Not at all," Jacqueline replied, carefully rearranging her hair. "As you yourself have often said, timing is everything.
I was talking about investing in art. My daughter is an exquisite piece of art, is she not? She belongs only in the finest collection.
A collection you failed to become part of."
"Fuck you, Oliver."
Chez toi ou chez moi?
Oliver naughtily arched an eyebrow as he sauntered out of the room. In the Andalusian courtyard, Rachel allowed her eyes to close for a moment. The strums of the Chinese zither created a perfect melody with the trickling waters, and the flowers in turn seemed to be choreographing their bloom to the mellifluous sounds. Every time a breeze blew, the copper lantern strung against the evening sky swayed like hundreds of glowing orbs adrift in a dark ocean. Rachel felt like she was floating along with them in some sybaritic dream, and she wondered if life with Nicholas would always be like this. Soon, the tanhuas began to wilt, just as swiftly and mysteriously as they had bloomed, filling the night air with an intoxicating scent as they shriveled into spent, lifeless petals. Chapter 5. Astrid and Michael, Singapore. Whenever her grandmother's parties ran late, Astrid would normally opt to spend the night at Tyersall Park. She preferred not to wake Cassian if he was sleeping soundly, and she would head for the bedroom, just opposite from Nick's, that had been set aside for her frequent visits since she was a little girl. Her adoring grandmother had created an enchanted emporium for her, commissioning whimsical hand-carved furniture from Italy and walls painted with scenes from her favorite fairy tale, The 12 Dancing Princesses. Astrid still loved the occasional night spent in this childhood bedroom, cosseted by the most fantastical dolls, stuffed animals, and tea sets that money could buy. Tonight, however, Astrid was determined to get home. Even though it was well past midnight, she swept Cassian into her arms, buckled him into his child seat, and headed for her apartment. She was desperate to know if Michael was back from work yet. She was kidding herself in thinking she could just look the other way while Michael carried on. She was not like those wives. She was not going to be a victim like Eddie's wife, Fiona. All these weeks of speculation and uncertainty had become a crushing weight on her, and she had to resolve this issue once and for all. She needed to see her husband with her own eyes. She needed to smell him. She needed to know whether there truly was another woman. Although, if she was being brutally honest with herself, she had known the truth ever since those four simple words flashed across this iPhone screen. This was the price she had to pay for falling for Michael. He was a man whom all women found irresistible. Singapore, 2004. The first time Astrid laid eyes on Michael, he was in a camouflage print Speedo. The sight of anyone over the age of 10 in one of those banana hammocks was usually repellent to Astrid's aesthetic sensibilities, but when Michael strutted down the runway in his Custo Barcelona Speedo, his arm around an Amazonian girl clad in a sheer black Rosa Cha bathing suit and emerald necklace, Astrid was transfixed. She had been dragged to Churchill Club for a charity fashion show organized by one of her Lyon cousins and had sat bored stiff throughout the proceedings. For someone used to a front-row seat at Jean-Paul Gaultier's elaborate flights of stagecraft, this hastily constructed catwalk, lit with yellow gels, fake palm fronds, and flashing strobe lights, seemed like underfunded community theater. But then Michael appeared, and suddenly everything went into slow motion. He was taller and bigger than most Asian men, with a gorgeous nut-brown tan that wasn't the sort you could spray on at a salon. His severe military buzz cut served to accentuate a hawk-like nose that seemed so incongruous to the rest of his face, it took on an overtly sexual quality. Then there were those piercing, deep-set eyes and the washboard abs rippling along his lean torso. He was only on the runway for less than 30 seconds, but she immediately recognized him a few weeks later at Andy Ong's birthday party, even though he was fully clothed in a V-neck t-shirt and faded gray jeans. This time it was Michael who noticed her first. He was leaning against a ledge at the bottom of the garden at the Ong bungalow with Andy and some friends when Astrid appeared on the terrace in a long white linen dress with delicate lace cutouts. "Here's a girl who does not belong at this party," he thought to himself. The girl soon spotted the birthday boy and made a beeline toward them, giving Andy a big hug. The guys around him stared open-mouthed.
"Many happy returns," she exclaimed, handing over a small present exquisitely wrapped in purple silk fabric.
"Aya, Astrid, I'm Sila. I said no presents on my Evite," Andy said.
"It's just a little something I thought you'd like from Paris, that's all."
"So, did you get that city totally out of your system? Back for good now?"
"I'm not sure yet," Astrid said carefully. The guys were all jockeying for positions, so as reluctant as he was, Andy felt that it would be rude not to introduce them.
"Astrid, allow me to introduce Li Shenwei, Michael Teo, and Terence Tan, all army buddies."
Astrid smiled sweetly at everyone before fixing her gaze on Michael. "If I'm not mistaken, I've seen you in a Speedo," she said. The guys were equal parts stunned and baffled by her statement. Michael just shook his head and laughed.
What is she talking about?" Shenwei asked.
Astrid peered at Michael's sculpted torso, which was clearly evident despite his loose t-shirt.
"Yes, it was you, wasn't it? At Churchill Club's fashion show to benefit juvenile shopaholics?"
"Michael? You modeled in a fashion show?" Shenwei said in disbelief. "In a Speedo?" Terence added. "It was for charity. I got dragged into it," Michael sputtered, his face turning beet red.
"So, you don't model professionally?" Astrid asked.
The guys all started laughing.
"He does. He does. He's Michael Zoolander," Andy cracked.
"No, I'm serious," Astrid insisted. "If you ever want to model professionally, I know a few agencies in Paris that would probably love to represent you." Michael just looked at her, not knowing how to respond. There was a palpable tension in the air, and none of the guys knew what to say.
"Listen, I'm famished, and I think I have to have some of that spicy-looking Mee Rubis noodles back at the house," Astrid said, giving Andy a quick peck on the cheek before striding back toward the house.
"Okay, Langsai, pretty boy, what are you waiting for? She was obviously into you," Shenwei teased Michael. "Don't want to get your hopes up, Teo, but she's untouchable," Andy warned.
"What do you mean, untouchable?" Shenwei asked.
"Astrid doesn't date in our stratosphere. You know who she almost married? Charlie Wu, the tech billionaire Wu Haolian's son. They were engaged, but then she broke it off at the last minute because her family felt that even he wasn't good enough," Andy said. "Well, Teo here is going to prove you wrong. Mike, that was an open invitation if I've ever seen one. Don't be so kiasu, man," Shenwei exclaimed.
"You're the one that's kiasu. I'm never afraid to lose because I never do," Michael said calmly.
Michael did not know what to make of the girl sitting across the table from him. First of all, this date should not even be happening. Astrid wasn't his type. This was the kind of girl he would see shopping at one of those pricey boutiques on Orchard Road or sitting in the lobby cafe of some fancy hotel, having a double decaf macchiato with her banker boyfriend. He wasn't even sure why he had asked her out. It wasn't his style to go after girls in such an obvious way. All his life, he had never needed to chase after women. They had always given themselves freely to him, starting with his older brother's girlfriend when he was 14. Technically, Astrid had made the first move, so he didn't mind going after her. Andy's talk about her being out of his league really irked him, and he thought it would be fun to bed her, just to shove it in Andy's face. Michael never expected she would say yes to the date, but here they were, barely a week later, sitting at a restaurant in Dempsey Hill with cobalt blue glass votives on every table, the trendy sort of place filled with Ang Moors that he hated, with nothing much to say to each other. They had nothing in common except for the fact that they both knew Andy. She didn't have a job, and since all his work was classified, they couldn't really talk about that. She had been living in Paris for the past few years, so she was out of touch with Singapore. Hell, she didn't even seem like a true Singaporean with her Englishy accent and her mannerisms. Yet, he couldn't help but feel incredibly drawn to her. She was the complete opposite of the type of girls he normally dated. Even though he knew she came from a rich family, she wasn't wearing brand-name clothes or any jewelry. She didn't even appear to be wearing makeup, and still, she looked smoking hot. This girl wasn't as xiao chie or high-maintenance as he had been led to believe, and she even challenged him to a game of pool after dinner. She turned out to be pretty lethal at billiards, and it made her even sexier. But this was obviously not the kind of girl he could have a casual fling with. He felt almost embarrassed about it, but all he wanted to do was keep staring at her face. He couldn't get enough of it. He was sure he lost the game partly because he was just too distracted by her. At the end of the date, he walked her out to her car, surprisingly, just an Acura, and held the door open as she got in, convinced he would never see her again. Astrid lay in bed later that night, trying to read Bernard-Henri Lévy's latest tome, but having no luck focusing. She couldn't stop thinking about her disastrous date with Michael. The poor guy really didn't have much in the way of conversation, and he was hopelessly unsophisticated. Figures. Guys who look like that obviously did not have to work hard to impress a woman. There was something to him, though, something that imbued him with a beauty that seemed almost feral. He was simply the most perfect specimen of masculinity she had ever seen, and it unleashed a physiological response in her that she did not realize she possessed. She turned off her bedside lamp and lay in the dark under the mosquito netting of her heirloom Peronican bed, wishing Michael could read her mind at this very moment. She wanted him to dress up in night camouflage and scale the walls of her father's house, evading the guards in the sentry house and the German shepherds on patrol. She wanted him to climb the guava tree by her window and enter her bedroom without a sound. She wanted him to stand at the foot of her bed for a while, nothing but a leering black shadow. Then she wanted him to rip off her clothes, cover her mouth with his earthy hand, and ravish her non-stop till dawn. She was 27 years old, and for the first time in her life, Astrid realized what it really felt like to crave a man sexually. She reached for her cell phone and, before she could stop herself, dialed Michael's number. He picked up after two rings, and Astrid could hear that he was in some sort of noisy bar. She hung up immediately. 15 seconds later, her phone rang. She let it ring about 5 times before answering. "Why did you call me and hang up?" Michael said in a calm, low voice.
"I didn't call you. My phone must have rung your number accidentally while it was in my purse," Astrid said nonchalantly.
"Uh-huh." There was a long pause before Michael casually added,
"I'm at Harry's bar now, but I'm going to drive over to the Lady Hill Hotel and check into a room. The Lady Hill is quite near you, isn't it?"
Astrid was taken aback by his audacity. Who the hell did he think he was? She felt her face go hot, and she wanted to hang up on him again. Instead, she found herself turning on her bedside lamp.
"Text me the room number," she said simply.
Singapore, 2010. Astrid drove along the meandering curves of Cluny Road, her head swimming in thoughts. At the start of the evening of Tyersall Park, she had entertained the fantasy that her husband was at some one-star hotel engaged in a torrid affair with the Hong Kong sexting tramp. Even while she was on conversational autopilot with her family, she envisioned herself bursting in on Michael and the tramp in their sordid little room and flinging every available object at them. The lamp, the water pitcher, the cheap plastic coffee maker. After Oliver's comment, however, a darker fantasy began to consume her. She was now convinced that Oliver had not made a mistake, and that it was indeed her husband he had spotted in Hong Kong. Michael was too distinctive to be mistaken for anyone else, and Oliver, who was equal parts schemer and diplomat, was obviously sending her a coded message. But who was the little boy? Could Michael have fathered another child? As Astrid turned right onto Dalvey Road, she almost didn't notice the truck parked just a few yards ahead, where a nighttime construction crew stood repairing a tall street lamp. One of the workers suddenly flung open the truck door, and before Astrid could even gasp, she swerved hard to the right. The windshield shattered, and the last thing she saw before she lost consciousness was the complex root system of an ancient banyan tree.
Chapter 6. Nick and Rachel, Singapore. When Rachel awoke the morning after the Tan Hua party, Nick was talking softly on the phone in the sitting room of their suite. As her vision slowly came into focus, She lay there silently, looking at Nick and trying to take in everything that had happened in the past 24 hours. Last night had been magical, and yet she couldn't help but feel a burgeoning sense of unease. It was as if she had stumbled into a secret chamber and discovered that her boyfriend had been living a double life. The ordinary life they shared as two young college professors in New York bore no resemblance to the life in imperial splendor that Nick seemed to lead here, and Rachel didn't know how to reconcile the two. Rachel was by no means an ingenue in the realms of wealth. After their early struggles, Carrie Chu had landed on her feet and gotten her real estate license right when Silicon Valley was entering the internet boom. Rachel's Dickensian childhood was replaced by teenage years growing up in the affluent Bay Area. She went to school at two of the nation's top universities, Stanford and Northwestern, where she encountered the likes of Paiklin and other trust fund types. Now she lived in America's most expensive city, where she mingled with the academic elite. None of this, though, prepared Rachel for her first 72 hours in Asia. The exhibitions of wealth here were so extreme, it was unlike anything she had ever witnessed, and not for a moment would she have fathomed that her boyfriend could be part of this world. Nick's lifestyle in New York could be described as modest, if not downright frugal. He rented a cozy alcove studio on Morton Street that didn't seem to contain anything of value aside from his laptop, bike, and stacks of books. He dressed distinctively but casually, and Rachel, having no reference for British bespoke menswear, never realized just how much those rumpled blazers with the Huntsman or Anderson and Shepherd labels cost. Otherwise, the only splurges she had known Nick to make were on overpriced produce at the Union Square Green Market and good seats to a concert if some great band came to town. But now it was all beginning to make sense. There had always been a certain quality to Nick, a quality Rachel was unable to articulate even to herself. But it set him apart from anyone she had ever known. The way he interacted with people, the way he leaned against a wall. He was always comfortable fading into the background, but in that way, he stood out. She had chalked it up to his looks and his formidable intellect. Someone as blessed as Nick had nothing to prove. But now she knew there was more to it. This was a boy who had grown up in a place like Tyersall Park. Everything else in the world paled by comparison. Rachel longed to know more about his childhood, about his intimidating grandmother, about the people she had met last night, but she didn't want to start the morning peppering him with a million questions, not when she had the whole summer to discover this new world. "Hey, Sleeping Beauty," Nick said, finishing his call and noticing that Rachel was awake. He loved the way she looked when she was just waking up, with her long hair so alluringly disheveled and the sleepy, blissful smile she always gave when she first opened her eyes. "What time is it?" Rachel asked, stretching her arms against the padded headboard. "It's about 9:30," he said, striding over and slipping under the sheets, wrapping his arms around her from behind and pulling her body against his. "Spooning time," he declared playfully, kissing the nape of her neck several times. Rachel turned around to face him and began to trace a line from his forehead to his chin. "Did anyone ever tell you," she began, "that I have the most perfect profile?" Nick said, finishing her question with a laugh. "I only hear that every single day from my beautiful girlfriend, who is clearly deranged. Did you sleep well?" "Like a log. Last night really took it out of me." "I'm so proud of you. I know it must have been exhausting having to meet so many people, but you really charmed the socks off everyone." "Ugh, that's what you say. I don't think that aunt of yours in the Chanel suit felt the same way. Or your Uncle Harry. I should have spent a full year studying up on Singapore history and politics and art." "Come on, no one was expecting you to be a scholar of Southeast Asian affairs. Everyone just enjoyed meeting you." "Even your grandmother?" "Definitely. In fact, she's invited us to come stay next week."
"Really?"
Rachel said. "We're going to stay at Tyersall Park?"
"Of course. She liked you, and she wants to get to know you better."
Rachel shook her head. "I can't believe I made any sort of impression on her." Nick took a stray lock of hair hanging down her forehead and gently tucked it behind her ear. "First of all,
You have to realize that my grandmother is exceedingly shy, and sometimes that comes across as being standoffish, but she is an astute observer of people. Second, you don't need to make any sort of impression on her. Just being yourself is quite enough. Based on what she'd gleaned from everyone else, she wasn't so sure about that, but she decided not to worry about it for the moment. They lay entwined in bed, listening to the sounds of splashing water and children shrieking as they did cannonballs into the pool. Nick suddenly sat up.
You know what we haven't done yet? We haven't ordered from room service. You know, that's one of the things I love most about staying in a hotel. Come on, let's see how good their breakfast is.
You read my mind. Hey, does Colin's family really own this hotel? Rachel asked, picking up the leather-bound menu by the side of the bed.
Yes, they do. Did Colin tell you?
No, Paiklin did. I mentioned yesterday that we were going to Colin's wedding, and our whole family almost had a fit.
Why?
Nick asked, momentarily perplexed. They were just very excited, that's all. You didn't tell me that Colin's wedding was going to be such a big deal.
I didn't think it was going to be.
It's apparently front-page news in every newspaper and magazine in Asia.
You'd think the newspapers would have better things to write about with everything that's happening in the world.
Come on, nothing sells like a big fancy wedding. Nick sighed, rolling onto his back and staring at the wood-beam ceiling.
Colin is so stressed. I'm really worried about him. The big wedding is the last thing he wanted, but I guess it was unavoidable. Araminta and her mum just took over, and from what I hear, it's going to be quite a production.
Well, thankfully I can just sit in the audience, Rachel smirked.
You can, but I'll be up there in the middle of the three-ring circus.
That reminds me, Bernard Tai is organizing the bachelor party, and it seems he's planned quite the extravaganza. We're all meeting at the airport and going to some secret destination. Would you mind terribly if I abandoned you for a couple of days?
Nick asked, stroking her arm lightly.
Don't worry about me. You do your duty, I'll do some exploring on my own, and Astrid and Paiklin both offered to show me around this weekend.
What? Here's another option.
Araminta called this morning, and she really does want you to come to her bachelorette party this afternoon.
Rachel pursed her lips for a moment. Don't you think she was only being polite? I mean, we just met. Wouldn't it be kind of weird if I show up to a party of her close friends?
Don't look at it like that. Colin's my best friend, and Araminta's a big social butterfly. I think it's going to be a large group of girls, so it will be fun for you. Why don't you call her and talk it over?
Okay. But let's order some of those Belgian waffles with maple butter first.
Chapter 7 Eleanor Shenzhen. Lorena Lim was talking on her cell phone in Mandarin when Eleanor entered the breakfast room. She sat down across from Lorena, taking in the hazy morning view from this glass eyrie. Every time she visited, the city seemed to have doubled in size. What was formerly a sleepy fishing village on the Guangdong coast was now a metropolis crammed with tragically gaudy skyscrapers, gargantuan shopping malls, and rampant pollution. In other words, Asia's version of Tijuana. In recent years, Shenzhen had become a favorite cheap getaway for its richer neighbors. Tourists from Singapore and Hong Kong, in particular, enjoy the thrill of feasting on gourmet delicacies like abalone and shark fin soup, shopping until midnight at bargain basement emporiums filled with fake designer goods, or indulging in hedonistic spa treatments, all at a fraction of what they would have to pay back home. But like a gangly teenager in the middle of a growth spurt, many of Shenzhen's hastily erected buildings, barely a decade old, were already being torn down to make way for shinier towers like this place Lorena had recently bought. It was shiny, all right, but sorely lacking in the taste department. Every surface in this breakfast room, for instance, was covered in a particularly putrid shade of orange marble. Why did all these mainland developers think that more marble was a good thing? As Eleanor tried to imagine the countertops in a neutral silestone, a maid placed a bowl of steaming fish porridge in front of her.
No, no porridge for me. Can I have some toast with marmalade?
The maid did not appear to understand Eleanor's attempt at Mandarin. Lorena finished her call, flipped off her phone, and said,
Aya, Eleanor, you are in China. At least try some of this delicious porridge. Sorry, I can't eat fish first thing in the morning. I'm used to my morning toast, Eleanor insisted. Look at you. You complain your son is too westernized, and yet you can't even enjoy a typical Chinese breakfast. I've been married to a young for too many years, Eleanor said simply. Lorena shook her head. I just spoke to my Lobang, my special contact. We are going to meet him in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton tonight at 8, and he is going to escort us to the person with the inside information about Rachel Chu. Carol Tai swept into the breakfast room in a luxuriant lilac peignoir. Who are these people you are taking Eleanor to meet? Are you sure it's safe? Yeah, don't worry. It will be just fine. So, what should we do until then? I think Daisy and Nadine want to go to that enormous mall by the train station, Eleanor said. You're talking about Luo Hu. I have an even better place to take all of you first, but it must remain top secret, okay? Carol whispered conspiratorially. After the ladies had breakfasted and beautified themselves for the day, Carol took the group to one of the many anonymous office buildings in downtown Shenzhen. A lanky youth standing at the curb of the building, who seemed to be texting away furiously on his cell phone, looked up when he saw the two late model Mercedes sedans pull up and a bevy of women emerge.
Are you Jerry? Carol asked in Mandarin.
She squinted at the boy in the scorching noonday sun, noticing that he was playing a computer game on his cell phone. The young man scrutinized the group of ladies for a minute, making sure they weren't undercover police. Yes, these were obviously a bunch of rich wives and, judging from the way they looked, they were from Singapore. These Singaporeans dressed in their own distinct hodgepodge of styles and wore less jewelry since they were always so scared of being robbed. Hong Kong women tended to dress alike and sport huge rocks, while the Japanese ladies with their sun visors and fanny packs looked like they were on their way to the golf course. He gave them a big toothy grin and said, "Yes, I am Jerry. Welcome, ladies. Welcome. Follow me, please." He led them through the smoked glass doors of the building, down a long corridor, and through a back door. They were suddenly outdoors again on a side street, across from which stood a smaller office tower that looked like it was either still under construction or about to be condemned. The lobby inside was pitch black, its only source of light coming from the door that Jerry had just propped open. "Be careful, please," he warned, as he led them through the dark space littered with boxes of granite tiles, plywood, and construction equipment.
"Are you sure this is safe, Carol? I wouldn't have worn my new Roger Vivier heels if I knew we were coming to a place like this," Nadine complained nervously. At any moment, she felt like she was going to trip over something.
"Trust me, Nadine, nothing is going to happen. You will be thanking me in a minute," Carol replied calmly. A doorway finally led to a dimly lit elevator vestibule, and Jerry jabbed repeatedly at the decayed elevator call button. Finally, the service elevator arrived. The ladies all crammed in, cowering together to avoid accidentally brushing against the dusty walls. On the 17th floor, the elevator opened to reveal a bright fluorescent-lit vestibule. There were two steel double doors on either end of the space, and Eleanor couldn't help but notice two sets of closed-circuit cameras installed on the ceiling. A very skinny girl in her early 20s emerged from one of the doors.
"Hello, hello," she said in English, nodding at the ladies. She inspected them briefly and then said in a surprisingly stern staccato tone, "Please turn off phone, no camera allowed." She moved toward an intercom, which she spoke into in a rapid-fire dialect that none of them could discern, and a set of secure locks clicked open loudly. The ladies walked through the door and abruptly found themselves in a sumptuously designed boutique. The floor was polished pink marble, the walls upholstered in pale pink moire fabric, and from where they stood, they could peer down the corridor into some of the adjacent showrooms. Each room was devoted to a different luxury brand, with floor-to-ceiling display cabinets crammed full of the most current handbags and accessories. The designer treasures seemed to glow under the carefully positioned halogen spotlights, and well-attired shoppers filled each showroom, eagerly perusing the merchandise.
"This place is known for the very best fakes," Carol declared.
"Holy Jesus!" Nadine shrieked excitedly, while Carol glared at her for using the Lord's name in vain.
"Italy this side, French the other side, what you want?"
the skinny girl asked.
Do you have any handbags by Goyard?
Lorena asked.
Hiya, yes, yes, everybody want Goya right now. We have best Goya, she said,
leading Lorena into one of the showrooms. Behind the counter were rows and rows of the latest must-have Goyard tote bag in every color imaginable, and a Swiss couple stood in the middle of the room testing the wheels on one of the Goyard carry-on suitcases. Daisy whispered into Eleanor's ear,
See, the only people shopping here are tourists like us. These days, the mainlanders only want the real thing.
Well, for once, I agree with the mainlanders. I've never understood why anyone would want a fake designer handbag.
What is the point of pretending to carry one if you can't afford it?
Eleanor sniffed.
Ayah, Eleanor, if you or I carried one of these, who would ever think it was fake?
Carol said.
Everyone knows we can afford the real thing.
Well, these are absolutely identical to the real thing. Not even the people who work at Goyard would be able to tell, Lorena said, shaking her head in disbelief.
Just look at the stitching, the embossing, the label.
They look so real because they practically are real, Lorena, Carol explained. These are what they call real fakes. The factories in China are commissioned by all the luxury brands to manufacture the leather. Say the company places an order for 10,000 units, but they actually make 12,000 units. Then they can sell the remaining 2,000 off the books on the black market as fakes, even though they are made with the exact same material as the real ones.
Hey, ladies, Guido Sea, everything is still so expensive, Daisy warned, scrutinizing one of the price tags.
It's still a bargain. This bag is 4,500 in Singapore. Here it's 600 and it looks exactly the same, Lorena said, feeling the distinctive texture of the bag.
My God, I want one in every color, Nadine squealed. I saw this handbag on British Traveller's It List last month.
I'm sure Francesca would want a few of these bags too, Lorena said.
No, no, I dare not buy anything for that fussy daughter of mine. Francesca will only carry originals, and they have to be from next season, Nadine replied.
Eleanor wandered into the next room, which was filled with racks and racks of clothing. She scrutinized a fake Chanel suit, shaking her head in disapproval at the gold buttons with interlocking C's running up the sleeves of the jacket. She had always felt that wearing a stiffly tailored designer dress of this sort, as women of her age and social milieu might be inclined to do, only served to reinforce one's age. Eleanor's style was a deliberate one. She preferred the more youthful, trendy clothes that she found in the boutiques of Hong Kong, Paris, or wherever she happened to be traveling, as this achieved three goals. She always wore something distinctive that no one else in Singapore had. She spent far less money on clothes than the rest of her friends, and she looked at least a decade younger than her real age. She tucked the sleeve of the Chanel suit back into its rack properly and walked into what appeared to be a room devoted to Hermès, finding herself face to face with none other than Jacqueline Ling. Speak of age-defying, this one had made some pact with the devil.
What are you doing here? Eleanor asked in surprise.
Jacqueline was one of her least favorite people, but even she would never have imagined that Jacqueline might carry a designer fake.
I just flew in this morning, and a friend insisted that I come here and pick up one of these ostrich leather purses for her, Jacqueline said, a little flustered to be seen by Eleanor at a place like this. How long have you been here? No wonder I didn't see you at Tyersall Park last night.
I'm here for a spa weekend with some girlfriends.
So, you are at my mother-in-law's for Friday night dinner?
Eleanor asked, not entirely surprised. Jacqueline was always sucking up to Nikki's grandmother whenever she visited Singapore.
Yes, Su Yi decided to have a little party at the last minute because her tanhuas were in bloom. She had quite a few people over. I saw your Nikki.
And I met the girl.
Well, what was she like?
Eleanor asked impatiently.
Oh, you haven't met her yet.
Jacqueline thought that Eleanor would surely want to assess the interloper as early as possible.
You know, she's typical ABC, overconfident and overfamiliar. I would never have thought that Nikki would go for someone like that.
They are just dating, La, Eleanor said a little defensively.
I wouldn't be so sure of that if I were you. This girl is already best friends with Astrid and Oliver, and you should have seen the way she was staring open-mouthed at everything around the house, Jacqueline said,
even though she had witnessed nothing of the sort. Eleanor was taken aback by Jacqueline's comment, but it soon dawned on her that on this score, at least, their interests were uniquely aligned.
"How is your Mandy doing these days? I hear she's dating some Jewish banker twice her age."
"Oh, you know, that's really just idle gossip," Jacqueline replied quickly. "The press over there is so fascinated by her, and they try to link her with all the eligible men in New York. Anyway, you can ask Amanda yourself. She'll be back for the coup wedding."
Eleanor looked surprised. Araminta Lee and Amanda Ling were arch rivals, and 2 months ago, Amanda had caused something of a mini-scandal when she told the Straits Times that she didn't understand what all the fuss was over the coup wedding. She was far too busy to come rushing back to Singapore for every social climber's wedding.
At that moment, Carol and Nadine entered the Hermes room. Nadine recognized Jacqueline immediately, having seen her from afar many years ago at a gala movie premiere. Here was her chance to get an introduction.
"Look at you, Elle. Always running into people you know everywhere you go," she said cheerily.
Carol, who was much more interested in the fake Hermes Kelly bags, smiled at them from across the room but carried on shopping, while Nadine made a beeline for the ladies. Jacqueline glanced at the woman coming toward her, taken aback by the sheer volume of makeup she was wearing. Oh my God, this was that awful Shaw woman whose pictures were always in the society pages, printing away with her equally vulgar daughter. And Carol Tai was the wife of that scoundrel billionaire. Of course Eleanor would be hanging around with this crowd.
"Jacqueline, so nice to meet you," Nadine said effusively, extending her hand.
"Well, I must be off," Jacqueline said to Eleanor, not making eye contact with Nadine, and stepping toward the exit nimbly before the woman could claim a proper introduction. When Jacqueline had left the room, Nadine began to gush.
"You never told me you knew Jacqueline Ling. Wow, she still looks stunning. How old must she be by now? Do you think she had a facelift?"
"A la Mac, don't ask me such things, Nadine. How would I know?" Eleanor said, feeling irritated.
"You seem to know her quite well."
"I've known Jacqueline for years. I even made a trip to Hong Kong with her a long time ago, where she couldn't stop making a spectacle of herself, and all these idiotic men kept following us everywhere, proclaiming their love for her. It was a nightmare."
Nadine wanted to keep talking about Jacqueline, but Eleanor's mind was already elsewhere. So Amanda had changed her mind and was coming home for Colin's wedding after all. How very interesting. As much as she detested Jacqueline, she had to admit that Amanda would be a superb match for Nikki. The stars were beginning to align, and she could hardly wait for whatever lay in store with Lorena's secret informer tonight. Chapter 8. Rachel. Singapore. The first hint that Araminta's bachelorette party was going to be no ordinary affair occurred when Rachel's taxi dropped her off at the Jet K CIP terminal, which served the private jet crowd. The second hint came when Rachel walked into the sleek lounge and came face to face with 20 girls who looked as if they had spent the last 4 hours in hair and makeup. Rachel thought that her outfit, a seafoam blue tunic top paired with a white denim skirt, was rather cute, but now it seemed a little shabby compared to the girls in their fresh off-the-catwalk ensembles. Araminta was nowhere to be seen, so Rachel just stood around smiling at everyone as snippets of conversation drifted her way.
"I searched the world for that handbag, and even Le Clair Lieu in Paris couldn't get it for me. It's a 3-bedroom in that old complex on Thompson Road. I have a gut feeling it's going to go unblocked, and I'll triple my money."
"OMG, I found the best new place for chili crab. You won't believe where."
"I like the Lanesborough Suites more than Claridge's, but really, the Carthorpe is where you want to be." "Nonsense, La. No Signboard Seafood still has the best chili crab. This isn't cashmere, you know. It's baby vicuña."
"Did you hear Sui Lin sold her Four Seasons flat for 7.5 mil? A young mainland Chinese couple paid in cash."
Yep. This was definitely not her crowd. Suddenly, an overly tan girl with fake blonde hair extensions came into the lounge shouting,
"Araminta just pulled up!"
The room got quiet as everyone craned their necks toward the sliding glass door. Rachel hardly recognized the girl who entered. In place of the schoolgirl in pajama pants of a few nights ago was a woman in a matte gold jumpsuit with gold stiletto boots, her wavy dark brown hair piled into a loose beehive. With a light dusting of expertly applied makeup, her girlish features were transformed into that of a supermodel.
"Rachel, I'm so glad you made it," Araminta said excitedly, giving her a big hug.